no matter what this lifeboat meant for their situation. The coming strike against the Jirohanai still needed to go forward without any other complications. They needed to send these bastards the message that their world wasn't up for the taking. Melody lay sideways on a flat, wide rock that radiated heat into her ribs. Despite the hard edges, she felt comfortable, almost sated, and didn't want to move at all. She stared at the snarled, stunted tree nearby for a long minute and enjoyed the faintest breeze across her skin. But she realized fuzzily, Sangheili ships didn't have stunted trees in them. Did they? She must have hit her head really hard. The last thing she remembered? Firing the plasma pistol over and over after she'd sat down in a storage bay on an ex-Covenant cruiser, blood dripping from her chin as she clutched her side. Melody looked along her body, grabbing for the spot and wincing. The jagged piece of metal didn't stick out of her uniform anymore, but under the ripped cloth, biofoam leaked out of the wound. Overhead, mountain peaks thrust into clear, saffron-tinted skies.
Where am I, Carol?
Melody struggled to stand, gasping and holding the torn skin just below her ribcage. A parched desert stretched away from her as she turned around, her back to the peaks. She was most of the way down the lower slopes of the mountains. Heat rippled in the air above the distant sand.
Rajka, what have you done? She called out. Are we on, Carol?
She staggered forward and dropped to her knees as the pain lanced through her stomach. The ground thudded as a half-ton of gray armor slammed down next to her. Melody looked up to see herself in the reflective visor bent down over her. Her curly hair flew every which way, and she looked so weary, an older version of herself. A crazed version.
Easy, easy, the massive Spartan said gently. You can't be walking, ma'am. You'll start bleeding again. We're making you a stretcher right now. Come, lie down.
He delicately picked her off the hot sand and carried her back over to the rock. Melody grunted as he placed her down.
How bad is it?
She pressed her hand to the tear in the uniform.
You have internal injuries. Our descent onto the planet was particularly rough.
The Spartan removed her hand. Please try not to move unless you have to. Melody raised her hand. Dark blood dripped from her fingers.
We're on Kero, right? Why are we down here?
Frankly, I was hoping you could tell us that, ma'am, the Spartan said. We were revived on a Covenant ship in the middle of a firefight between two groups of elites, and dropping down here was our only option out of it.
Melody slumped onto the rock.
Not good. I'm Melody Azikiwe. I'm an envoy for the Unified Earth Government. What's your name?
Jai-006.
Great team. As I live and breathe, Melody said, half smiling.
Not that there would have been other Spartans in old Mjolnir armor frozen away in the holds of a Sangheili cruiser. For some reason, though, the confirmation buoyed her spirits. Slightly.
Are the rest of them with you?
I'll talk about who is and who isn't here after you explain some things to me.
Melody gave him an exhausted look.
I was the one who got you out of the cryo chambers. And to be honest, we really don't have the time for all this. What happened to the Sangheili ship? How long have I been out?
She may have sent her staff down to Kero to hide and survive. But Melody now was on a completely different task, thanks to Oni. Something that was more important than maintaining the Sangheili Alliance. More important than extracting her staff. More important than even protecting the 1 million humans left on Kero. She needed to get off planet immediately and send a warning back to Earth. Passing out had really screwed things up. She was going to have to scramble to piece together a new plan.
How'd you do it? Jai asked bluntly, interrupting Melody's new train of thought.
How did I do what? How did you get onto a Covenant vessel and free us? We found you armed with only a plasma pistol.
Covenant vessel, Melody thought. They don't know how much everything has changed around them.
Well, first of all, she told Jai, it's been about 6 years since your team went under. A lot has changed. That wasn't a Covenant cruiser. It's Sangheili now. The Fleetmaster, Rajka Kassan, is the Kaidan for the Sangheili city-state of Rak here on this planet. The Covenant, as you knew it, no longer exists. We won the war in a battle on Earth in late 52. We allied with a sect of Sangheili rebels who turned against the Covenant. Allies, like Rajka Kassan.
Late 52?
The Spartan didn't move or say anything for a moment. The date seemed to hold a lot of importance. After processing that, his helmet tilted. It doesn't look like all the fighting is done. We woke up in the middle of a battle.
Yeah, well, that part's complicated.
More important, where exactly are we right now? We had a brief window of communications with a human city here on the planet right after we made landfall. But there was no response. We got as close as we could in the last 3 hours, but we only ended up here in the mountains. By foot, we're still pretty far from the city.
Okay. That human city is Suraka, Melody explained. They began resettlement here on Kero shortly after the war. Melody relaxed slightly, now that she knew they weren't near Suraka.
Jai crouched down and looked up into the sky.
Wait a second. So there are Sangheili and human populations here on this planet, side by side?
Melody nodded, then winced at the movement. Kero lies deep inside something the UNSC refers to as the Joint Occupation Zone. There are a number of JOZ worlds in this region that used to be part of the Outer Colonies. The UNSC and our Sangheili allies, we're all trying to create some order out of the chaos. We had some setbacks of late. It's been challenging on a lot of fronts. Here on Kero, human refugees came back to resettle Suraka. When they arrived, they found Sangheili keeps already being built around a river on the other side of the Ult Desert. They'd been here for some time.
The Sangheili are leaving their own worlds and just settling human colonies in the JOZ?
No, not quite. The current Sangheili leadership wouldn't allow subordinates to just go off and do something like that, especially in a politically sensitive territory. But these Sangheili are special. They're the survivors of Gliki, one of their worlds that was devastated during the war, Melody explained. She noticed a slight shift in the Spartans' stance. They actually needed somewhere to go, and they started their settlement shortly after the war's end. Jai continued to look at her with that inscrutable helmet. She continued. They had several months of a head start on the human refugees. They'd fallen through the cracks, so to speak. When the humans returned here and found the keeps, it was far too late. In some ways, I think the leadership in both the UEG and Sangheili circles were wondering if a jointly occupied world would actually work, if it was even possible. A true sign of interspecies cooperation. Maybe it was a social experiment on their part. Whatever you want to call it. But human settlers out in the desert, people who separated themselves from Suraka, have apparently been clashing with Sangheili over various oases. Some fighting occurred. Some people died. To the UNSC leadership monitoring this situation, it looked like full-on armed conflict here on Kera was about to break out. So what happened then?
The UEG thought it best to formally broker a meeting between the Kaidan of the Sangheili city-state and Soraka's governor. So, here I am, the envoy entrusted with helping negotiate peace and harmony. Obviously,
It all kind of fell apart, didn't it? As she shifted her position, Melody spotted that the other two Spartans, despite their incredibly heavy armor, had deftly snuck up on either side of her.
"But we saw Sangheili fighting each other. Not humans," one of them said, the slight Slavic accent in voice, along with female Mjolnir body armor, confirmed for Melody that it was Edriana 111.
"At the time," Melody said, "but the opening attack was actually a Sangheili faction moving against Soraka. They disabled everything with slipspace drives, and completely cut off any off-world communication so that Soraka couldn't call for help." The other Spartan, who had to be Michael 120, stepped forward.
"I'm confused. Who are the good guys now, ma'am?"
"Like I said, that part's a little more complicated," Melody said, concerned that this entire explanation was taking too long. Getting the Spartans up to speed was important, but time wasn't something she had a lot of. "I was embedded with Fleetmaster Rajka Kassan, the Kaidan of the city of Rak. My staff and I were to give him advice on how to communicate with the colonists, as they had ties to the insurrection before the Covenant War. There were things the UNSC wanted out of the peace talks that made our presence something of a third party."
"You mean to tell me we're all back to fighting among ourselves again?" Chai said. "There are splinter groups operating in the JOZ. Soraka is one of many. They are not considered hostile, though the UEG would like to figure out how to bring them back into the fold. Soraka wants to be independent, but doesn't seem to have any intention of initiating any formal resistance."
"So they probably won't welcome us with open arms," Chai said. "We represent the UNSC.
I'd say a Spartan presence would be met with a lukewarm reception at best.
Particularly since peace talks failed and the Sangheili destroyed all FTL-capable ships. Besides," Melody reminded herself, "Soraka was not the direction they needed to be going. Heading into the city right now would be a big mistake."
"Who did the destroying, though?" Mike asked. "We saw the Sangheili fighting each other. Guessing that someone in the Kaidan's ranks didn't like the idea of making peace?"
"Yes, that's pretty much it. There was a big falling out between Rajka Kassan and another called Tharz Sarov. Tharz really doesn't like humans. He initiated the attack, citing weakness on the part of the Kaidan for aligning with the humans, though it was so well planned. I'm certain that there's a wider scheme at play for him. So we contact your friend Rajka and ask for a ride out of here," Chai said.
"Can't do that."
Melody looked around at the three Spartans. They were so damn tall.
"Why?"
Melody let out a sigh. "Well, here's yet another part that's complicated. Apparently, Rajka wants you three dead, just as much as Tharz does. There's something that happened during your last mission. I couldn't get clearance to find out what. Rajka would always change the subject whenever asked. I know only that he found your lifeboat several weeks before I came on board. That's one of the reasons I was there. Oni sent me to get you all out. I was to try and secure your release on one hand, while publicly negotiating peace for Kero with the other." Melody saw the Spartans look at each other, a slight tilt of the helmets. Then Jai said, "You need medical attention. We all need food and supplies. After that, we can figure out the next step to get back where we need to be. Any thoughts, Melody?"
"Okay. So that's how it's going to be."
"Still getting my bearings, but there's a research facility in the northern part of the Carfu Range," Melody told him. "That must be this series of mountains."
"Haven't heard any beacons," Mike told Jai. "No one's responded to me."
Melody took a deep breath.
"Yeah. They won't. It's an Oni facility. Gila Station. They're not going to break silence. But that's where we should go for help. My staff should be there.
Resources, too. There she'd be able to use the Oni prowler that came in periodically to resupply the site and get the Spartans back to the proper authorities. And, more importantly, she could call for help and get off planet. It was imperative that she warn Oni about the potential compromise of their target on Caro.
Okay, Grey Team, said Jai. I say we head to Gila Station and try to avoid everything out here that Melody says wants to kill us.
Mike had already ripped branches off a tree and lashed a makeshift sling between them with webbing. They placed Melody into it as she checked over a crude paper map she had kept on her person. Not being able to carry anything too sophisticated aboard the Sangheili ship. It was covered in blood now. But she could make out enough to guide them. Once he had rough coordinates from Melody, Jai grabbed one end of the branches and Mike the other. They casually lifted Melody in the air and started walking. Adriana followed behind them with a larger branch, twitching it behind her to erase their footprints.
What's all that smoke from the other side of those mountains to our backs? Melody asked.
Sangheili ships, as far as we could tell, Mike said.
Thar's contracted Jirohanai mercenaries for his coup against Rajka, Melody noted. Some of those ships could belong to the brutes.
Then there were probably some Jirohanai as well. Everything upstairs was beating the hell out of each other as we came on down. And Soraka has some cruiser hovering above it right now. When we patched into the city's comms, I heard some chatter about Jirohanai being on the ground there.
Must be your mercenaries.
Jirohanai on the ground in Soraka. That was even worse than Thar's and his Sangheili. Melody wondered if she shouldn't have kept her other secrets from the Spartans. The Spartans had chosen not to disclose why the Sangheili wanted them dead so badly. And Melody was keeping confidential information of her own. Strict orders. But under the circumstances, she wasn't sure how long she was going to be able to stay quiet.
Chapter 10 Jai ran across the desert, falling into a rhythm with Mike as Melody slept in the crude stretcher they carried between them. Adriana was still bringing up the rear, wiping their tracks and keeping an eye out for any surprises that might sneak up on them.
Everyone is pissed off at us, Jai said via helmet-to-helmet communication.
We have a long run ahead with no water, no food, no supplies.
Reminds me of training.
Mike waited several moments before responding.
I'm not sure if the biofoam will hold her together.
Okay, Jai thought. They were only going to talk about the task at hand. No pleasantries. She held off elites with only a pistol. She's a tough one.
Or suicidal. You know she's lying to us, right?
Yes, Jai had noticed that. She has Oni ties. They keep things close.
Oni. Just saying that cast a dark cloud over both of them.
They kept running along for another long spell of silence.
Jai felt the team slipping away again.
They would come together to fight, to stay alive. But everything else he tried to say was met with cold indifference from the other two. Jai had never had that much authority over Grey Team. The three of them, each orbiting around each other so tightly, had always moved together as one. They'd found each other in the hell of Spartan 2 training. Since then, they'd been inseparable. Grey Team against the galaxy. But this last mission had become a real thing between them all right now. Leaving Jai feeling like something had been ripped out from inside him. Leaving a hole he couldn't fill.
Oni has lied to us often enough, Mike said. I'm not sure that what we're doing is wise.
Saving a life? Jai responded.
Is that what we do? Mike asked. Save lives?
I haven't done that in a while, Jai.
I take lives.
That and orders.
And now we come back and find out that the war is over.
But there's still some kind of war going on, Jai said.
There always is, isn't there?
Mike pulled a little harder on the stretcher. Jai had to wobble to compensate and not spill Melody out into the sand. She groaned and stirred.
First it's the insurrection.
trying to keep humanity from falling apart. Then it was the Covenant, 30 years of hell. Now it's something else. There's always something else.
Melody flopped an arm out of the sling stretcher, waking up and trying to sit up to look around.
You're okay, Jai told her. You're okay.
Doesn't feel like it, she said.
Her dark brown face had paled even more since the beginning of the run.
She was probably bleeding internally.
I'm tired.
How did you get assigned to the Sangheili fleet here? Jai asked.
Melody smiled up at him. I speak the language. I've studied the culture. I did some work in Sangheili refugee camps out here in the JOZ.
Jai couldn't believe he was hearing the words.
Are you serious? A refugee camp?
You're going to hear a lot about what's called the Great Schism. That's what they call the big breakaway where the Sangheili rebelled against the Covenant when their prophets decided to give the Jirohanai military superiority. Their entire alliance disintegrated. The Sangheili paid a heavy price in the last days of the war, and ultimately helped us win. So, the UNSC sent volunteers to help Sangheili stranded across human-occupied space get relocated into JOZ locations.
You mentioned the Covenant made it all the way to Earth, Mike said.
Yes, Melody said, not long after the glassed reach.
And now we have Sangheili allies. Jai couldn't help the slightly confused tone in his voice, bitter and angry. It sounded crooked and disgraceful to him that after so much fighting, so many killed by Sangheili soldiers, they were now allies.
The Sangheili who rebelled against the prophets, they came to our aid. They fought against the Covenant with us. I mean, it was either that or extinction. Like I keep saying, it's complicated. Everything isn't perfect, but it's an important relationship now.
But for some reason, the Sangheili here still want us dead, Jai said.
They probably have very good reasons, Mike said softly.
Now it was Jai's turn to fall silent. He glanced behind them. Adriana had thrown away the branch and ceased hiding their footprints. But she still hung back, refusing to speak now that they were just eating up the kilometers.
Was she going to stay quiet all the way to Gila Station?
Jai couldn't force her to talk.
Then again, maybe it was better they just never brought up what happened.
It was almost 6 years ago, even though in some ways it felt like just yesterday.
The longer Jai thought about it, the more he wanted to bury it all in the past and pretend they had never experienced it in the first place.
But if they did that, could they ever fall back into being a cohesive team? Or would there always be this distance between them from now on? Was this the best it would ever be again? With this ever-widening rift of mistrust and doubt?
Maybe.
And if the rift remained, it could well be the end of Grey Team.
But maybe we deserve it, Jai thought grimly.
Melody carefully watched the body language of the three Spartans while feigning disinterest. It could be hard to glean information about the super soldiers, but by listening closely to their voices and looking at their interactions, even if masked by half a ton of powered assault armor, a trained envoy like Melody could see some hidden underlying signs.
Something had clearly broken this team.
For one, Adriana refused to speak unless it was absolutely necessary. The rest of the time she remained withdrawn from not just the team, but really anything else at all. She was remote and detached. When she did interact with the other two, Melody could sense something angry and feral curled up inside her. Mike, up in front, expressed his anger by questioning little things that Jai did, bits of verbal sniping, followed by purposeful long silences and then changes of topic.
Jai was reined in behind an unspoken sorrowfulness, a black cloud eating up every last piece of invisible rage thrown his way, as if he deserved it. They'd been floating in deep space for years, undiscovered, dead quiet. Why were they there in the first place? Melody had some theories she'd worked on while aboard Unwavering Discipline. She was willing to bet that Gray Team had been behind enemy lines and engaging in some kind of unconventional warfare. The sort of desperate, last-minute things Oni cooked up when all of their other plans failed miserably. When their backs were against the wall. In a war they were quickly losing. The personnel she had interacted with from Oni wouldn't tell her anything about Gray Team's mission. All they had conveyed was that after 6 years MIA, they'd been found by Rajka Kassan somewhere in Sangheili space, just weeks before she was assigned to be envoy. Oni wanted them back, and unofficially Melody had been told to oblige any offer Rajka made to return them. Oni seemed desperate. But no matter how many times she carefully made that clear, that anything Rajka wanted was on the table, the Fleetmaster had refused to talk about them. "They are demons," was all Rajka would utter when they met privately about the Spartans, the very subject upsetting him enough that Melody would drop it. Her staff had looked terrified whenever Rajka acted like that. Even his own retinue, the hand-picked few around Rajka whom he trusted with the knowledge that the Spartans were on board, seemed uneasy about the subject being brought up. "We will discuss their fate after the treaty. After we decide the fate of Rakoi. Not before." Melody smiled. Her staff. Adam, Victoria, and Jens. It would be good to see familiar faces again. They'd bonded under some horrible circumstances. Refugee riots in Valles Marineris on Mars. People throwing bottles at her from behind a barricade of furniture, just outside an office building in the Tenderloin District, shouting at the soldiers not to fire. Usually, hard times pulled people in uniform together. Not Gray Team, though. Not on the last mission, whatever it was. She looked over at the endless sand dunes that sprawled off to her right. The Spartans had been on the move for hours. They'd been thawed from cryosleep, shot at, dropped out of orbit, crash-landed in the middle of a desert, and now they were plowing on. Just how the hell did they do it? One step at a time, apparently. Or in Melody's case, one wheezy breath at a time. She coughed, wiping the backs of her fingers across her lips and looking at the blood on her fingernails. That wasn't good. She realized that she might have to tell them the truth sooner than expected. Give up that dark secret and hand over to the Spartans the burden of what she knew about this world. The real reason Oni sent her here. They weren't cleared for it. But she had little choice, didn't she? Melody Azukiwe knew. She was dying. The Jirohanai cruiser Phobane hung over Saraka, its great weapons now silent. Hecabe pointed at the bottom of the deep pit they'd excavated. "There!" Anexus squinted. Hecabe retrieved his gravity hammer, as well as an object wrapped in old cloth and thorn beast leather, from an armored receptacle he had brought with him from Phobane. He then carefully picked his way down the smooth, gentle slope at the side of the pit. The hole stretched several kilometers from one side to the other, with an increasingly steep decline toward the center, 100 meters deep at the very least. In some places, the vitrified soil that remained still glowed red from the ship's plasma bombardment. The heat singed the unshaven fur around his legs, but he paid it no mind. The Nexus gingerly followed him. Hecabe had ordered the rest of his packs to stay back at the edge of the pit to protect his secret. "Yes, I see it." Smoke curled away from a 15-meter spire in the middle of the pit. As they approached, its details became more visible. The spire, which seemed to be a stark ivory color at first, finally caught the light and glinted, its oily blue and green surface shifting colors slightly as the sun played across it. Hecabe quickened his pace toward the spire, ignoring the heat of the barely cooled ground all around him. A nexus had paused to stamp at a small part of his leg that had caught fire.
"Exactly where the holy writs declared," Hecabe said, deeply satisfied.
He grabbed a nexus by the arm and dragged him forward.
"Now I can tell you what I seek. Chieftain, when we displaced the Sangheili by the prophet's side as honor guard, most of our kind assumed we had succeeded in everything. We were promised the richest planets, the greatest forerunner reliquaries, total authority over the Covenant military. We knew we would stand with the prophets when the great journey began."
The ground cracked and popped as they walked across it. A nexus glanced nervously around. The crust under their feet threatened to break, dropping them down into the liquid rock that likely still roiled underneath. The oppressive heat made a nexus pant as he carefully followed. His weakness, even in the hour of their triumph, was dissatisfying to the chieftain.
"When the prophets proved only to bring ruin on the Covenant by failing to secure the Ark and the Sacred Rings, still I did not lose hope. What remained of our people were scattered, fleeing from our new position of power to other hidden worlds. But I never rested a nexus," Hecabe continued. "Most would assume our kind to be incurious and primitive. But I took advantage of the opportunities presented to me while we had power firmly in our claws."
Hecabe had used his newfound authority aboard one of the Covenant cruisers to wage the final battle against the human and Sangheili forces on the Ark, the Forerunner's great foundry preserve that had created the ancient Halo Ringworlds. The Sacred Rings were made to kill a mysterious parasite known as the Flood, and usher their makers into the divine beyond. But what remained of the Covenant was defeated by the Sangheili's treachery, and so killed any hope for the great journey. Hecabe thought it might also be the end of all that the Jirohanai had achieved in their coup. And then he found this. The leather-wrapped object he carried. Stealing the object Hecabe had brought to this world meant risking his entire pack on a stealth attack in the middle of this tragic defeat. Hecabe had led his warriors on a mission deep into the underworld of the Ark, when High Charity, the holy city of the Covenant, crashed into the foundry's surface, releasing the Flood across its surface. As the parasite infested the Ark, and Sangheili and Covenant ships fought above, Hecabe led his pack into the depths, finding this object, a holy relic, one of the most significant machines ever conceived of by the Forerunners. He had lost many good warriors that day. It was nearly 6 years later that he managed to decipher the relic's hidden meaning and find the world it pointed to. Rakoi. Pledging the warriors he'd gathered to himself in those 6 years to the weaker Sangheili Kaidan on this world, and then betraying that arrogant rodent Tharz had been the last step on Hecabe's long journey toward power. Hecabe stopped at the foot of the spire. This structure, which he had risked everything to expose, was finally here in front of him. The spire was only the tip of what was buried deep, all the way to this planet's mantle. Its roots reached down toward the magma. Based on what he had encountered on other worlds, Hecabe believed that it could power itself forever off that molten rock.
"Do we blast our way in?" a nexus asked. "Only if you wish to die. This is far enough."
He carefully put the relic on the ground, adhering to the ritual he had learned from the sacred writings. The leathery covering sizzled and caught fire, quickly dissolving to ash. A metal box was revealed, forerunner hieroglyphs imprinted on its sides. The symbols briefly flared with embers.
Hecabe opened the box by pressing grooves on its sides, ignoring the pain from the heat, and wrapped his large hands around a fist-sized, pearly metallic orb embedded into a blue-gray helmet-like device, composed of strange ancient metal that seemed almost malleable. The moment he touched the object, blue arcs of energy traced their way through the metal, like the slow-moving lightning strikes he had seen many times sailing across the water graves of Wario. The blue light lit Hecabe's face from underneath in a ghoulish glow.
"Remember this moment, Anexus," Hecabe said, as he carefully lifted the alien device up into the air. The ruined ground beneath them hummed, as though a mechanical sleeping giant rose from its slumber somewhere far below the crust of the cooling stone they stood on. Something indescribably vast, ancient and powerful stirred. "This is the moment where Jirohanae no longer struggle for their place, where none of us will have to negotiate peace through weakness, but instead we will demand respect by way of our strength." The spire trembled. Seams appeared on its sides and began to open. "Our homeworld has been shattered. We are reduced to stealing from other species just to survive. The Sangheili called us beasts of burden, mere thralls to be ordered. And they laughed."
Hecabe shook his head sadly.
"I say instead, we will rise. We will take what is rightfully ours, what the prophets could never provide. And you, Anexus, you will one day tell others of this story, that you stood by me to see this glorious day."
The spire before them now split apart, opening like a giant beak at first, then splitting yet again. Each sliver of spire lowered itself like a drawbridge until what had once been seamless turned into four enormous triangular petals flowering before the sun. Each of the petals quickly fell open into the weakened rock, throwing up molten debris as their backs struck the surface. Hecabe watched with interest as the nearest petal struck ground just a few strides away. Melted rock pelted down around his legs and feet, some of it sizzling on his armor. He moved forward with the device in his hand and stepped onto the pedal. It was surprisingly cool under his foot, the heat unable to penetrate through the metal. The pedals had parted to reveal an open core, a sheer ledge that surrounded a hole which fell down into the darkest depths of the planet. Ornate ramps impossibly spiraled around the core, carved into the gray metal structures. They seemed to wend in and out of the raw bedrock. A red glow illuminated the empty abyss of the shaft. Entire handfuls of the tallest buildings in the city around them could be swallowed up in that dimness, Hecabe realized as his eyes adjusted to the scale.
"Come, Anexus," Hecabe ordered. "Summon the Warpacks to join us. They too should bear witness to this event."
Anexus instead looked frightened, peering down the suddenly formed entrance to the structure.
"What is it?" "Power, Anexus. Power that the prophets would have hid from us all. What lies beneath would have let us win the war against the humans and the Sangheili. It is what will make us strong again. Come with me, and I will show you what the gods attempted to keep secret, even from their own kind."
Chapter 11 Rajka Kassan stood near a small body of water as one of his warriors crawled out of it onto its muddy bank. After the crash of the unwavering discipline, and after he had fought for his life while trapped on his own command bridge, He had overseen salvaging whatever the surviving crew could from the wreckage. They had dragged out weapons, equipment, and supplies onto the side of the mountain, and then quickly continued their hunt.
"The humans' escape craft is down there, Fleetmaster. But there are no bodies."
Rajka looked at the disturbed water. Shimmering, rainbow-colored oil coated the surface. The tracker that Rajka had tagged the Demon III's ship with had failed when they landed in this very spot. Presumably their arrival had been violent. He silently hoped there was injury involved. But not fatal. Rajka himself wanted the honor of providing that. Then the Demon III must have shoved their escape craft into the water.
"Was there a sign of fire in their craft?" Rajka asked.
The warrior looked surprised.
"Yes, Fleetmaster."
A number of Sangheili were scattered around the site, keeping their weapons aimed up the mountain in case of ambush. Others walked the grounds, looking for clues along the giant run of plowed earth the human pod had clearly made when it crashed.
"They pushed it into the water to extinguish a fire?" Daga asked.
"But where did they go afterward?"
Scanning the location intently, Rajka walked the area in circles and stopped near a tree with several broken branches. He pushed at the branches, gauging their strength.
"No one has found any demon armor."
"No, Fleetmaster."
"The envoy is wounded, and they carry her," Rajka announced.
There were missing branches that had been broken free. He guessed they had been lashed together with some ties.
It could feasibly carry a human, but not a Spartan.
"That will slow them."
He looked at another broken branch from a leafy section of the tree.
"Clever. They would use that to disguise their tracks."
"What is it?" Daga asked.
"Look for any disturbance leading away from the site. Not the prints of their feet. Any disturbed ground. Something that could not have been caused by the wind. Everyone!"
As Rajka turned, he again caught the pillar of smoke up the mountain range. Unwavering discipline burned still. Rajka growled in the back of his throat. Since he had learned to walk, he had looked up to the vessels heading into the inky black of space and wanted nothing more than to command one of them. He had all but worshipped the greatest and most renowned of Covenant shipmasters his entire life, and he had fought so hard toward the goal of being one himself. To stand with a control dais beneath his feet. Life once had such purpose. Yet now his ship lay destroyed on this planet's surface. Half of the surviving crew he had been forced to leave behind. They would attempt to fix whatever they could pull from the wreckage. Then catch up to him. The other half, who now stood around Rajka, equipped with a handful of working vehicles, hunted the Spartans with no delay. And the crew who had perished, Sangheili who looked to him to pilot them among the stars, lay inside the ship. They had died fighting the intruders, or as their own ship fell apart around them on impact. Their bodies, too, would become part of the pyre of his own dreams. All his hopes had been swallowed up by deceit and betrayal. Tharz Saraph, the envoy, the Demon III. Daga moved beside him, looking in the same direction.
"We lost many. We tried to build something here on this world, Daga. Now it is all ashes. We cannot even defend Rak. Our lineages will be vulnerable to the Jirohanai and the Spartans. Maybe even the humans. We have failed."
Maybe the humans were right in the way they fought for life, not honor. Perhaps survival was tantamount, not the integrity of valor. Had he not been goaded into this battle with Tharz, Rajka could have simply withdrawn to protect his keep at Rak. Or hidden away and waited until he was stronger. He thought back to the cool river running through Kasan Keep, the cylindrical spires of his greenhouses and the columns of the courtyard in his half-built home, the trees, the farmlands just outside of it, those who remained in Rak, who were right now likely laying supplies in the bunkers and wondering if they had a future.
So many things had changed.
Would Rajka end his life questioning everything?
Was nothing he had been taught by his uncles on the sand of his keep back on Glaki set in stone?
Certainly not, because Glaki itself had been destroyed. It almost felt like everything he had thought and believed on that world had been swept away along with it.
Daga had looked startled to hear his fleetmaster admit defeat, even tentatively.
Maybe, Rajka thought, Daga too would try to kill him soon.
Was Rajka really a coward? Perhaps secretly, somewhere deep inside, his reason for coming to the surface was to survive Tharza's attack, in order to just live.
Rajka looked away from his ruined cruiser in the far distance.
We who live owe a debt to those who perished today. We must continue our fight.
Those warriors have returned and wish to report to you. Daga pointed to three Sangheili standing farther down the slope, waiting. They found the disturbed ground you ordered them to look for. It appears that the Demon Three headed out into the desert. They may have changed course once out in the sand, though, as the wind has blown over their trail.
Rajka considered their path. They will likely be headed to the human city. So they could still hunt the Spartans and bring vengeance.
He had that much, at least. Rajka banished his dark thoughts with a blast of anger.
Send the banshees we have up ahead to scout for them. But stay low. Tharz might still be looking to see if any of us survived.
Tharz, Daga spat. Both Sangheili looked up in unison at the peaks of the mountains beyond discipline, and the plumes of distant smoke from the other crashed vessels. They had been listening in on communications between Tharz and his commanders. Some of his fleet had survived the Jirohanai attack, but only at great cost and with severe damage done to their vessels. Without the ability to quickly repair their ships, and with limited resources themselves, Tharz would be grounded as well, especially given that what little survived of his fleet, licking their wounds in a suborbital drift, remained completely out of communication range. But Tharz's patrols were headed for the remains of unwavering discipline. That much was clear. Soon the fighting would begin anew.
Tharz doomed us all with his poor strategy, Daga said. To fight an evenly matched battle is to destroy both parties. It is something to do only if one is desperate and certain that the only enemy is the one you currently fight.
We were not true enemies, Kaidan. Tharz is a fool who should pay with his life.
Eventually, Rajka said. But Tharz was only a distraction. He looked back out at the desert.
First, we find and kill the demons. That is all that matters for the moment.
They had covered so many kilometers that when the three Spartans stopped, Melody was taken aback. She expected them to just keep running until they got to Gila Station. But they were human, she mused. They had to have limits at some point.
Mike dug a pit in the sand on the lee side of a dune and placed Melody's stretcher gently into it. The warmth from the sand seeped through her clothes. She wriggled gently against it, letting it form to her back.
Thank you, she said. That's a lot more comfortable than the webbing.
It won't be a long stop, Mike said. We just need time to let some lactate clear out of muscle tissue. Then we can press on.
Remember training? When Mendez's excuse was that he was just curious about how far we could go before collapsing, Chai asked.
I threw up three times, Mike said.
You came up with the idea of carrying each other when someone needed rest, so we didn't have to stop. Just to mess with his head.
500 kilometers, 3 days. Mendez finally stopped it because he started to get worried, Mike said, with what might have been a slight chuckle.
Okay. They had limits. But not small limits, Melody thought. She could easily tell each Spartan apart, but primarily by the damage to their Mjolnir armor. All their battle scars made each of them distinguishable.
The bent cap over the visor, that was clearly Chai. Mike had two scarred divots over his left breastplate in a rough X. An energy sword had clearly come dangerously close to him. Twice. Adriana had burn marks across the back of her greaves, as if something had blown up near her legs. Those were the obvious bits of damage. Each Spartan had additional unique gouges and dents, as well as normal wear and tear. All of them told a story. Some little piece of hell that Grey Team had somehow managed to survive.
"This isn't boot camp," Adriana spoke up. "We don't get to jog. We have to keep running and watch our backs."
The moment of levity broke. Melody watched Adriana wander over to a nearby sand dune. She faced north, her back to them.
"Thank you," Melody muttered as Mike made sure she was comfortable.
Then he crested the dune to go and face the Carfu Mountains in the west, where they'd come from. He disappeared from Melody's sight, though she heard his armored feet crunching across sand for another few seconds. Chai silently settled down just over her head at the top of the dune.
"You almost had a moment of camaraderie there," Melody said to him.
"Almost," Chai agreed, his voice neutral.
"Is this going to affect your ability to fight if someone catches up to us?"
Melody figured a challenge might draw the Spartan out. "The only time we fall back to normal, Envoy, is when facing action. For a brief moment, after we woke from cryo, it felt that way again."
"Your team is broken," Melody said in a low voice. "It's obvious even to someone on the outside."
"Whatever you say, ma'am. We're still operational." Melody shifted to try and get a better look at the Spartan. The movement sent a dizzying spike of pain through her stomach.
"That's what you think. But what happens when things get really bad?"
"We woke up in the middle of a firefight on a Covenant warship, and now everything we thought we knew about what's going on out there is all wrong." Jai waved up at the sky. "Yesterday's enemies are now supposedly our allies, but for some reason they're still trying to kill us. We fight all the way down here, crash land, and are now being chased into the desert by some very angry aliens. How much worse can it all get?" Melody turned her head so that the Spartan couldn't see her expression.
"Oh, believe me, it can," she said. "But I'm hoping it won't. I'm so sorry."
She sighed and ground her head against the sand.
"Sorry about what?" Adriana asked sharply. "That I unfroze you and brought you into all of this mess. Now you have to deal with..."
"Shh," Chai said.
"No," Melody continued quickly. She needed to know they could handle what came next if she gave them the truth. "Something's coming."
Chai stood up, sand cascading from his armor and blowing over her in a gritty burst of rain.
"Oh."
Adriana had now turned and raised her plasma rifle.
"Banshee," Chai said, calmly.
"Contact imminent. At least some things don't change." The three Spartans waited in place for a brief moment. Melody strained her ears. Right on the edge of audibility, she could hear the whine of something swiftly approaching.
"Stay down," Chai told her.
Plasma fire shattered the peaceful scene as the Banshee suddenly appeared overhead and wheeled back around in a blur to shoot into the dunes. Molten sand sizzled and pooled. Chai leapt into the air, firing at the vehicle as it swung around for another run. Melody ignored his instructions and twisted around to watch him bounce from dune to dune, dodging the plasma fire and an intermittent explosive fuel rod that jettisoned from its undercarriage. Adriana launched off into the air as well, the leap making her seem like an armored cricket. Her own rifle streamed plasma fire that seemed to perfectly curve up not to where the Banshee was, but to where it was headed. She was leading her target. And at this range, it was very impressive. The Banshee smacked into the line of fire and immediately wobbled. It attempted to swerve back to where it had come from. But Mike had already been waiting for that with a third barrage of plasma. With a loud cracking sound that cut through the air, the vehicle's sealed carapace split open. A Sangheili fell out of the cockpit and down to the sand, as the crippled banshee continued its track and disappeared off into the distance, finally exploding between the dunes. Idriana hit the ground next to the Sangheili.
Dead, she reported. Melody felt an odd twinge of sadness. She might very well have met that pilot while aboard Rajka's ship.
Jai looked toward the burning wreckage, smoke rising before the harshly orange setting sun.
96 kilometers to go, he said. And now they know where we are. Time to get moving again.
Vice Governor Lamar Edwards spread images out on a view screen in front of the generals as Elise Gass entered the all-too-familiar confines of the planning room and its oversized conference table. She looked around.
What is this? Pope?
Travis looked completely lost.
The meeting was last minute. I don't have an agenda.
Vice Governor? Elise asked, her lips pressing together, the words sharp and questioning. Lamar pointed his index and middle fingers at the screens. The Jirohanai have been ruthless about any attempt by us to get eyes on what they're doing. They've used their cruiser to shoot down pelicans. We've lost drones, recon teams, anything that gets near. Until now.
Grainy, motion-streaked pictures of the brute-occupied terrain filled the screens.
I thought there was going to be an update on our naval force, Elise said. I wanted a precise ETA on their arrival in orbit.
An F-99 we had hidden at Azar was dispatched 3 hours ago and managed to transmit about a dozen images before they shot it down.
We now have intelligence that needs consideration, Lamar said. It places our decisions in a new light.
Elise glided into a seat. Here was the old veteran who had once claimed to her over drinks that military intelligence was an oxymoron, and laughed when he said it.
Lamar, at our last meeting we talked about the alternatives, and now he was ambushing her.
The Jirohanai have not tried to expand out past clearly demarcated zones, Lamar continued. We wondered if they were just holding the area. Now we know. They are excavating. We saw similar behavior from the Covenant during the war. The three generals and Lamar turned to look at Elise and Pope.
So, Governor, it's not an invasion, Kapoor said. I think we are just accidentally in their way.
Right, Lamar said. He pointed at one of the images. There was something buried under that part of the city.
So then it's twice as important that we strike.
Elise stopped herself from shouting by steadying herself before continuing.
Since when has an archaeological dig by anything Covenant-related ever resulted in them uncovering something for the greater good?
You've read some of the reports about the things the Covenant searched for during the war.
So have I.
This could spell disaster. The galaxy is apparently full of destructive forerunner machines waiting to be dug up, and they usually wind up getting a lot of people killed. We need to hit them hard before they find whatever's down there.
Lamar swept most of the on-screen images aside and pointed to a single zoomed-in and enhanced photo of what appeared to be splayed-out metal leaves on the ground.
Elise could see a vertical shaft and large spiraling ramps heading deep underground, like threads on a screw nut.
It's too late, Governor. They're already down there. The reason we were able to get close is that a large number of Jirohanai are no longer present here. Most have actually left the occupied area and gone into the Ult.
Lamar? What you're doing?
All I'm doing is presenting information and choices, Governor.
Generals. Lamar pointed at the picture up on the screen again, his face nothing but earnest and concerned.
You mentioned the Covenant excavations in the past, Governor. Well, I've been on the ground when things like this have happened before. I've seen it with my own eyes, and I've seen the toll in the lives of people who've had to go through it. We need to think about saving people now before it's too late.
As of yesterday, Lamar, everyone here has also been on the ground for things like this, Elise snapped.
That's why I want the damn ETA on the ships, so that I know we have something in orbit to attack the Jirohanai before they do move to kill us all.
General Grace spoke up. The fleet will